If you do crossword puzzles, you know that the words are all laid out on a grid. Has it ever occurred to you to wonder how someone even begins to make that grid? It's really complicated, and it's something that David Steinberg, a star in the world of crosswords, has been working on perfecting since he was 12. He got good enough that he was publishing puzzles in the New York Times at age 14. His puzzles were being syndicated in his home state of California by the time he was 15, but lest you think that means he's been doing this forever, he hasn't. He's only 22 years old. And right out of college, guess who snapped him up with a job offer? Andrews McNeil here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to meet the crossword puzzle prodigy who just moved to town. David Steinberg, welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you.
Is that a lot of pressure to move someplace and have people be like, the prodigy is among us?
Yeah, it is. It's a very different culture from the place I'm from in California. So,
yeah. When did you arrive?
About a month and a half ago.
Do you look at cities the way you look at puzzles? Like, have you analyzed the way our urban grid is laid out, and could you make improvements for us?
I have not thought about it that way, but that's interesting. Yeah.
So you're fresh out of Stanford, a lifelong Californian. This must be quite a change, and I have to assume you had other options.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a change weather-wise. Like, I think I was okay with the heat in August and early September, but then it dropped down to 40 degrees the other day, and I was like, what is this?
And if 40 degrees is what is this, I hate to tell you, January might be a rude awakening. But there are advantages to living in Kansas City. We'll get back to that, but let's get your story. What got you hooked on puzzle construction at 12, as I mentioned? What sparked that?
Yeah, I saw a documentary called Wordplay, and in the documentary, there was a scene at the end where a professional crossword constructor named Merle Regal made a crossword by hand, and he made it look so easy. And, you know, I saw this documentary when I was 12, and I was like, I could do that, right? So the next day, I went upstairs and took out a piece of graph paper and tried my hand at constructing myself.
How'd that go?
Yeah, it was a lot harder than Merle made it look, I'll tell you that.
So then that first puzzle that actually got published, from working on it to the thrill of having it accepted, I would love to hear that story, like just that experience as a 14-year-old.
Yeah. Well, let's see if I can put myself back in my mind state of a 14-year-old.
Let's travel back there now.
Yeah, so this is actually the 17th puzzle I'd constructed. The first 16 were all... Yeah, Will Shorts is very nice, but he had good reasons for rejecting them.
So you sent him all 16?
Yeah. And, you know, I think I kind of got better and better as I continued to send more. And then the 17th one came back as a maybe instead of a note.
So was that, like, in the form of an email or something?
Yeah, it was all email.
So was it just one word, maybe?
No, Will, it was a code-related puzzle, and he wanted I was kind of had a coded message, and he wanted the message to be related to code somehow.
Oh, so he wanted the code itself to refer to codes.
Yeah, because what I just had random words coded with this code system I had. So, you know, I had to rethink the theme a little bit.
So tell me, you know, you became really prolific really fast, and in fact, you were the most prolific puzzle constructor for the Times in 2013. That same year, you were named Man of the Year by some big crossword puzzle organization, and I've done the math, you would have been 16.
Yeah, well, it was a big honor for sure.
So paint the picture of your junior high and high school years, because I'm thinking about what that must have been like, juggling school and whatever else with an active career on a level that most of us don't ever achieve.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, it was so my first crossword came out in the Times right about when I graduated from middle school. And then...
Did the kids at school know that that had happened?
Yeah. It was I think I announced it at my middle school graduation, so...
And then, how did people respond?
Oh, they were all really excited, you know, because they knew I had been into crossword puzzles, like solving crossword puzzles for a while. And I think some of them knew I'd been trying to get one into the Times, too. So,
and so then that was like part of the celebration of graduating from middle school. I would like you to know that I was applying puffy paint to t-shirts in celebration of my middle school graduation. But so then, like, you go on to high school. Just tell me about what a day in the life was like, because published in the Times and going to your freshman year in high school, this to me is like different worlds.
Yeah, it was kind of weird, you know. I just, you know, my passion at that point was and still is crossword puzzles, and so I didn't necessarily, wasn't really necessarily excited about starting high school and having to take harder classes and stuff like that. And so, you know, I did my schoolwork, and then after school I would construct crosswords or eventually start edit crosswords, and then I also ran a project to convert a bunch of old New York Times crosswords into a format where they could be seen.
Yeah, the pre-Shortzian project, the pre-Shortzian crossword project.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I have read about this project, and I am intrigued that not only did you want to create puzzles, but that you wanted to sort of revive puzzles of the past.
Yeah, so I had always been curious about the old Times crosswords. I knew the Times crossword had started in February 1942, but the only ones I could see online were from the Shorts era, from November 1993.
And that's Will Shorts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. From November 1993 to present. And so I'd heard stuff about the old crosswords, like, oh, these are really bad, and they're full of tons of obscure entries and stuff like that, but I wanted to see for myself.
So the reputation was that they were bad?
Well, by today's standards, yeah. You know, it was just, there was a lot more obscurity back then.
So, but it sounds to me like you must not have agreed, or else why would you bother converting them and archiving them?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of interesting stuff in them, too. Not necessarily puzzles I'd want to solve, but some of the themes from back then were really interesting, and just to see how themes and answers developed over time.
Can you give me an example of something that was just interesting for its own sake, not as, like, because it was the greatest puzzle ever?
Yeah, yeah. It was, there was a lot of stuff in the crosswords from the 50s and 60s about the space race and the moon landing and stuff, so it was really cool to see an astronaut being included as, like, a modern hero or something like that. So
just gives you a sense of, like, what was on people's minds, what people cared about and knew about?
Yeah, yeah.
But so take me back to a little bit more of that high school experience, because, you know, like, you have a family, you have friends, like, what else was going on? Like, were you, like, in pajamas doing crossword puzzles while, like, making plans for the weekend or something? I don't know.
Yeah, something sort of like that. Yeah. Yeah, so the project kept me very busy, because I ended up managing about 60 volunteers by the end. So I was spending just about every spare minute I had outside of classes either, you know, sending puzzles to people to convert, or constructing new puzzles and sending them to the Times, or eventually editing my own weekly crossword for the Orange County Register's Associated Newspapers.
And then what about college?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I finished high school. And then at first I was thinking, well, I don't know if I can necessarily make a living out of crossword puzzles. You know, I love what I do, but, you know, I have to find something that really pays the bills. And so I was like, okay, well, you know, maybe I'll kind of scale down the constructing I do and go major in computer science. That was my plan, at least.
What happened?
Well, I took the first computer science course that I was going to take in the fall of my freshman year, and it was really hard, and it wasn't quite as fun as I remembered it being in high school.
So did you change your plan?
Well, I wasn't sure what I was going to do at that point. You know, I was like, well, I don't know if I necessarily want to do computer science anymore, so I took a little bit of time to explore other subjects and maybe try to find something I was more passionate about.
What did you find?
Crossword puzzles.
Explain that.
Yeah, so after my freshman year of college, I went to intern for Will Shorts, and I slept on his couch that summer.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah, and my job was to look through the hundred plus submissions a week that Will receives and try to read his mind, essentially, and sort them into piles. Like, these are the ones I think Will's going to like, and these are the ones I don't think he'll like as much.
So that you were doing some, like, pre-sorting for him, and then he could go back into either pile, but...
Yeah, yeah.
And what was it like to sleep on his couch?
It was a comfortable couch, you know. And there was there were big piles of submissions on the table in front of the couch. So, you know, I probably had dreams about crossword submissions at one point.
So, but you were able to change your major to crosswords?
No. So I ultimately, I did that for a couple of years, this internship for Wilt, while I was still exploring what I wanted to do. And that was one of the really nice things about Stanford was you have to declare a major at the end of your sophomore year, but you're still really flexible and you can change around. And so I was still trying things and I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll, not sure exactly what I'll do for a major, but maybe I'll go work for the New York Times after I graduate. But the thing was, Will and his team got so many submissions that they really needed a third person there full time. And you know, I was still in college, so.
Yeah.
So then they, I had to rethink what I wanted to do again. And then that's when I got a call from Andrews McMeel.
So, you use software programs to search for words now, but I read this piece you worked on for the Times. It was a tutorial on how to make a puzzle, and it sounds like making the grid is the biggest challenge for you. Explain what that means, making the grid.
Yeah. So I think, so what I do is I'll start with a theme, and for most puzzles anyway, and I do make my share of themelesses, but for a theme, I'll start with maybe 3 to 5 symmetrical theme entries, and then I'll lay them out in the grid, and then I place the rest of the black squares, and I'd say the biggest challenge is filling in the rest of the answer words.
So then, as I mentioned, you can use software programs to do that now, but people used to do it with a reference book, and had pages and pages of different options for, say, like all the 5-letter words with W as the second letter. That is crazy. Have you seen that book?
I have, yeah. And I have a little bit of a collection of old crossword books and artifacts.
Tell me about the book. Like, did you ever use it for your own work, or were you just like, no, I am a 21st century crossword constructor?
No, I never used the reference book because I think pretty early on I discovered I could look up words online, and there are a lot of websites where you can type in a letter pattern and that'll save you the trouble of opening the book to the right page and stuff. So,
your relationship with, you talked about that you do this pre-Schwartzian crossword puzzle project. You also have a like larger relationship with the history of crossword puzzle construction, and it's very personal. There's a really famous puzzle you worked on, and we're talking about that special kind of fame reserved for really niche things. But a famous crossword puzzle you made with a woman by the name of Bernice Gordon. At the time, she was more than 80 years older than you. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. I think I'm trying to remember exactly how we got connected. I think it was through the pre-Schwartzian puzzle project. And I went to visit her in Philadelphia one time, and, you know, it was really fun to see her, you know, and to see how she still constructed and had all her reference books and everything. And so we decided to make a crossword together, you know, and the puzzle was themed to the revealer across the center was age difference. And so half the theme entries added age to a common phrase and half of them removed age.
Wait, what do you mean? Oh, the letters A-G-E?
Yeah.
Okay, give some examples.
Oh man. So it was let's see if I can
around like maybe the crossword's gonna appear in front of your eyes.
Yeah, I have to jog my memory a little, but it was, I don't know if I can remember any specific examples from that puzzle, but it was something like where man turns into manage when you add
age.
And it was part of a longer phrase too, and the result was funny.
So Bernice Gordon died at 101, and working so closely with her, getting to know her at the end of such a long and storied career, did that teach you anything that you're grateful you didn't have to wait 80 years to figure out for yourself?
I don't know if I learned any specific lessons in like crossword construction, but just the amount of energy she applied to crossword puzzles at that age really inspires me. So, and I hope that someday when I'm that age, I can be the same way. So.
Do you try to solve other people's crosswords?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What is your approach? Like, what's your technique?
Yeah, so usually I don't always start at one across. And sometimes I'll just kind of start with the first thing that leaps out to me that I know, and then I just kind of build from there.
Do you recommend that approach?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of times if you always work the puzzle the same way, sometimes the clues in the at one across can be hard, and so it can be a bit discouraging.
Do you go for speed in your crossword puzzle solving?
Yeah. I try to solve them as fast as I can, and I've competed in a number of crossword tournaments over the years.
So, I mean, every job has those moments of satisfaction. Every job also has its frustrations, but I want to focus on the moments of satisfaction where you just get that, like, this is why I do this feeling. You know what I mean? What is that moment for a crossword constructor?
I think for a constructor, it's really about when you come up with a really cool theme that you're really excited about, or a clue that no one's done before that's, you know, people are going to be like, oh, that's a really good clue.
Can you give an example?
Yeah. I actually have an example from a universal crossword I edited recently, and I'll give the clue first. The clue was one concerned with inequalities in education, ?
One concerned with inequalities in education, ?
And the question mark indicates that some sort of wordplay trickery is going on.
Okay, what is it? What's the word?
The answer is math teacher.
Ha! Inequalities.
Yeah, you got it.
It took me a second. It's like, math teacher? Okay. So your job at Andrews McNeil, speaking of that, is you're the puzzle editor, puzzles and games editor.
Yeah.
So what other than crossword puzzles does that entail? And has that been a challenge for you?
Yeah, I've been working on creating some new games. I can't say too much about them right now, but...
And I understand that part of what your arrival signals for Kansas City is that our crossword scene is supposed to grow.
I hope so, yeah.
How would that happen?
Well, I think the crossword tournament that KCUR does every year is a really good start.
Featuring crossword, I'll call him crossword obsessionado Dan Margulies.
Yeah, but you know, I think crossword tournaments are a great way to bring constructors, solvers, and other enthusiasts together. So,
do you have any questions about Kansas City, like real quick before we go? Anything I can help you with?
Wow.
I'm a lifer. I can help.
Aha. Uh-huh. What's your favorite restaurant?
Oh, I can't answer that, but I'll tell you off the air. David Steinberg, it's been really fun getting to know you, and I hope you like it here.
Thank you.
David is a crossword puzzle celebrity just recently hired on by Andrews McNeil in what most crossword fans consider a coup. So score one Kansas City, and I will tell him my favorite restaurant off the air. Up next, an art exhibit in Lawrence takes on the complexities of international adoption from the adoptee's point of view. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and now I'm joined by the artist behind an exhibit called Foundling, on view at the Spencer Museum of Art in Lawrence. The exhibit includes paintings of 100 people adopted as children by parents in the U.S. from countries in Asia, Africa, Eastern Europe, and Central and South America. The paintings are all based on referral photographs given to U.S. families by international adoption agencies in the whole adoption process. The artist herself was born in South Korea and adopted by a U.S. family in Minnesota, and that personal history is a big part of what inspired her. Megan Rye, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll get into the details of the art you've created and the scale of the project you've taken on, which is huge, in just a moment. I want to start, though, with you and your story. What was going on in your life that made you want to explore your own adoption story and the stories of others?
I have been very, very uninterested most of my life in exploring my adoption and being adopted. I grew up in Minnesota. I was born in 1975, and so I grew up in a very Caucasian Midwestern suburb outside of Minneapolis when all I really wanted to do was fit in. So I deliberately did not want to eat Korean food as a child. I did not want to go to Korean culture camp. I did not want to take Korean language classes, all which my parents offered to give me. But when I had my own children, something really pivotal happened. My son was born, and a few years later, my daughter came. I was flipping through my family photo album one day, and I'd always known my referral photos, these six little black and white, frayed, crinkly images were in the family photo album. And I've always been aware that they were there, but until my daughter was born, I had never really deeply looked at them. And in that moment, I was just astounded at the difference between having my own children and having all of this information. I had 3D fetal images, I had locks of their hair, I had footprints, I had them on the chest, my chest, the moment after they were born. And I realized that all I had from Korea, from my 7.5 months there, were these six little black and white photographs, and that was all. And the gulf between my own experience with my children and just having these six little images was so huge. In that moment, I realized there was a story to tell.
Yeah, and when you're a parent of a newborn, what 7 months means is very different from when you're growing up and you find out, oh, at 7 months old, this thing happened.
Exactly. And that always seemed like such a small amount of time. Well, I came when I was a baby. But after carrying children for 9 months and then living their first month, the first 3 months they're alive, the first 6 months they're alive, all of these months and milestones are so critical in terms of growing and developing and bonding. And to imagine that I just arrived one day at 7.5 months, extremely malnourished, all of a sudden became very significant.
What do you know about those 7 months?
Absolutely nothing. And I think that that difference is what is so striking. Some adoptees do have information, names of their biological family, details. I really didn't come with anything. I was left on the police steps with a note pinned to me that said, take care of this baby. And that was all. And that was a story that was very common of Korean adoptees, I think, in the 70s.
You were part of a wave of international adoption in Minnesota, I understand. Can you explain that?
Minnesota has a very high percentage of adoptees, and particularly Korean adoptees. It's interesting, 50% of the Korean population in Minnesota has been adopted.
And adopted during that particular time period, or just over many, many years?
Well, it's interesting. I think in the perhaps 60s and 70s, that was the first beginning of a first big wave of international adoption to the United States and to Minnesota that doesn't actually exist anymore. In the 70s, 80s, 90s, there were many, many children that came to Minnesota. And since that time, adoption agencies have closed down, they've consolidated, they've gone out of business. There are many countries in the world that sent children that were very poor, and now they have a large middle class. Worldwide, the stigma of being a single mother has changed. And so for a lot of reasons, the babies are not being sent.
So I am curious what feelings you have surrounding what you just described. I mean, even saying something like talking about that there had been a kind of poverty in some places where now there's a stronger middle class. The idea that something like the level of economic development in a country is going to determine who raises you is a really profound thing.
Well, Korea after the war was incredibly poor, and I visited Korea about, 8 years ago, and it's now an incredibly wealthy country. There are also changes, for example, in China, where the one-child policy no longer exists, and so there's no longer a need to send girls to another country because you're only allowed to keep one child. So there are many countries that there have been a great deal of change.
As a Korean child being raised by a white family in Minnesota, what was your experience of race and cultural identity? I know you wanted to fit in, but can you take me inside your mind at that time a little bit more?
I think that being adopted, surrounded by mostly very loving, well-intentioned community, you're always faced with some questions that just don't exist for people that are not adopted. For example, the question, and I've interviewed and had conversations with so many of the people in this project and gotten to know them. One question that comes up and has come up for me, but for many people, the simple question, where are you from, is complicated and loaded. I've had so many people say, you know, people lean in and ask, where are you from? And Minnesota's not an acceptable answer. They want to hear, you know, that you're from China or you're from. And so if you say, oh, I'm from Minneapolis or I'm from St. Paul, they'll say, no, where are you really from? But then also sometimes the reverse can happen where someone once told me in college, someone asked, well, where are you from? And she launched into this long story about, you know, being born in China and being adopted. And really all her new college friend wanted to know is if she was from Minneapolis or had grown up outside of Minneapolis. So you're always faced with these questions that for anyone else would just be very simple to answer. And I think I felt that too growing up. And people want to know, do you speak Korean? But then why not? And so I think you're always just very aware. I was also very aware of many times I felt no hostility, but in Minneapolis still, I'll go to a wedding, I'll go to a funeral, I'll go to a conference, and I am the only person that's not Caucasian in the entire room, and you notice.
You've written in your artist statement that being adopted is being twice born. Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by that?
Well, I feel like there are two things that happen when you're adopted that are very significant. Obviously, the first is when you're abandoned or given up or relinquished into the care of the police or the hospital or wherever you're left. And then the second moment is when you're claimed again. And so I think that those two moments are always part of being adopted.
You have said that this art project you've done, and we're going to talk about it in more detail now, that it's something you wanted to do to honor families on both sides of that adoption story, biological families and adoptive families. What is it specifically that you want to honor in each case?
Well, it's interesting. People have asked me why the target bags are important.
Okay, I'll jump in and explain that. These are portraits painted on target bags, as in
yes.
The giant retailer.
It's interesting. Some of the bags have the slogan on them, expect more and pay less. And to answer your question, I'll talk a little bit about that slogan. Some people have looked at the slogan and said, expect more, definitely plays on expecting a baby or being expectant. And it's interesting, pay less has been interpreted in very different ways. One person said, our tax policy supports so many things. International adoption is so expensive. I think via our tax policy, we should support the creation of families. Adoption should literally cost less. We should support it. Someone else took that in a very poetic direction and said, for me to belong to a family, someone had to give up a child. And I love my family. I love being adopted, but I wish that there wasn't I wish that my birth mother didn't have to pay a price. I wish there wasn't a price to be paid for me to belong to a family. So to answer your question,
or just the idea of a price tag on a person, which isn't, you know, yeah.
Exactly. And I think that this project is not about the economic structure of global adoption, but I think the fact that we are these faces are on shopping bags, I'm also not shying away or ignoring that fact either.
Well, so you worked from referral photographs provided to you by international adoptees who wanted their stories told, wanted their stories considered. How did that work exactly? How did you make contact, reach out, interact with all of these people and their stories?
Well, I started with the adoptees that I knew, so family and friends and neighbors, and that was about 30 people. And then I realized that it was going to be very important for me to have 100 portraits. In Korea, there is something called historically, there's the 100th day celebration where they celebrate an infant on its 100th day of life, with the assumption that if you reach 100 days in the past, that you would probably make it to a year and beyond and have a childhood and you'd survive. And I think that celebrating survival and finding 100 portraits was very important because I wanted to really celebrate and commemorate survival from all of these children and myself being going from being homeless to having a forever family, from being a foundling to being a citizen of this country. Celebrating 100 and memorializing 100 was very important and connected to that idea of 100-day survival.
And then how did you connect with the people who you met beyond your own social network and personal experience?
It was really kind of a leap of faith for so many people. The 30 people I knew, I just said, you know, I'm working on this project. I don't know where it's headed. I don't know where it's going to lead. I don't know where it's going to be exhibited. But if you have friends and in your own adoption community, would you mind sharing this project? And very, very few people were not interested in contributing, which I found amazing. I mean, people always ask me how to describe adoption, and I think it's a leap of faith. It's an act of love, but I also think it's a complete leap of faith to give a complete stranger your referral photos and know they're going to be painted on Target shopping bags. So for all the families and adoptees who have participated in this project that I did not know, that was, I think, a huge leap of faith.
And so you painted the photographs. Did you ask people to tell you their stories in any detail, or did that happen organically or not on a case-by-case basis?
I thought it was going to be really important to give every adoptee and their family a place in the exhibit where they could tell their own story in their own words. So everyone has their portrait painted, and it's hanging on the walls. And I'm also creating a book where people can write something and I'll include it, or I'll interview them and write it up myself and they'll have the ability to edit it. I've also told people that if at any point in this process they want to take their story back, it's very easy for me to just take it out of the book. Or if at any point in their adoption journey they're not ready now to tell their story, but maybe it's going to be exhibited in 2 years and they want to share something then, we can certainly include it. So it's very
important for
me. It's more
like a photo album type book where things can be added.
Well, no, exactly, because I think, you know, a lot of times an artist will use an image or use a story and then kind of that's it and it's set in stone. But it's really important for me to have this book be a living manual where people can add and take things away, and people's stories will change. I mean, if this work travels for 5 to 10 years, children who are in their teens or in their 20s, they're going to be at a different point in their adoption journey as they graduate from high school, as they get married, as they have children of their own. And so people's stories will change.
It really, something that just really moved me as I was listening to you is that the decision or pressure, whatever the case may be, that you are going to relinquish a child or that you are going to adopt a child, that can feel like one of the, like an incredibly permanent decision. And the importance that you place on being able to change your mind is really significant to me.
Well, this project should really empower the adoption community, and that starts with the adoptees in the project.
Explain that.
It's interesting. There have been so many adoptees who are taking heritage trips, and a lot of them, a heritage trip obviously is visiting your home country, and a lot of these trips take place over the summer. So I started asking people in last winter and spring, you know, would you like to be a part of this book? Would you like to write something? Would you like to have a conversation for me to write up? And people were thinking about it or working on their drafts, and then they realized I think five people this summer, in fact, were going back to their home countries and said, well, I'm going to have this huge, significant trip. And I'm, you know, let's wait and talk about it after I return. And so I think there are these milestones in every person's life. But certainly if you're adopted, I've noticed through these conversations, graduating from high school, deciding whether you're going to take a heritage trip or not, deciding if you're going to search for birth family or not. When, you know, it's another big one is people, there are people in this project in their 20s and 30s getting married, having children or thinking about having children. And they've, like myself, have said, having children has made me wonder about birth family in a way that I never have before. And so several people have said, in fact, this project has made them think about their history more than they ever have before as well.
I'm Gina Kaufman talking with the artist Megan Rye about her painting exhibit at the Spencer. It's called Foundling. It depicts real people born overseas, adopted here in the U.S., and it explores their complex personal stories. You can join the conversation with your story, whether you've experienced adoption as a parent or a child. 816-235-2888 is the number to call, but do it now. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to artist Megan Rye about her exhibit at the Spencer Museum of Art in Lawrence, 100 portraits of people who, like her, were adopted across international lines by U.S. families. Hi again, Megan.
Hello.
You can call 816-235-2888 to join our discussion if you have a story to tell or a perspective to add. 816-235-2888. Megan, you've hinted at this, but as you've traveled around with this exhibit and given talks in a lot of cities and also just met and interacted with all the people who have given you their referral photos to paint from, you have met so many people who have a relationship to the topic of adoption. And I'm wondering if there's anything that they've wanted to talk to you about or seen in this exhibit or gotten from it that even you, as someone who has lived this story yourself, didn't anticipate.
People have wanted to know why I'm painting on Target bags to begin with. And I think that that is also part of the story of this project. It's been really important for me to connect Minnesota adoption stories to an emblem of Minnesota, which is the Target logo. Back when this huge wave of international adoption took place in Minnesota.
And Target is a Minnesota company.
Exactly. Target was not the national or international company it's become. It really was a Minnesota company. And so I really wanted to combine these portraits with the Target symbol. And visually, in terms of the composition, depending on where the portrait is placed on Target bags, and there are three different designs that I've used in this exhibit, the Target symbol itself can suggest a beating heart, a chosen object. It also suggests the circle on the Korean flag itself, even though there are adoptees represented from Romania, China, Russia, Guatemala, Ethiopia, Colombia, and India as well. And so the Target bag is connected to the Minnesota adoption stories. But people have said, well, where did you get the idea in the first place? When my son was really little, we ran out of things to paint on one day. And there are all these Target bags around our house. And so I just said, well, let's use these Target bags. So we had been painting on Target bags with my son and daughter since they were really little, just because we ran out of white paper. And the relationship to Target itself as a family is really funny too, because you know, we practically live at Target. We're there every day. We buy all of our food and our clothes and diapers at Target. And also, it's kind of my son, it's been a place where we've hung out. He really, really loves the lawn furniture section. And he really likes to go, you know, I don't feel guilty about this because we buy everything else at Target. But when he was really little, he wanted to go to choose books. And we'd take a little stack of books. And then he'd want to go sit in the lawn furniture section. And we'd read the books together. And so I have all these memories of taking my son to Target when he was, you know, 1, 2, and 3. And then he also did something really funny at Target. He had choose something, one of these books, and he would hide it in the lawn furniture section. And then he always wanted to go back and see if they found it and put it back, or if it was still behind the cushions or still behind that potted plant. And sometimes the same book would be there for weeks.
To you, how does this tie back into the themes that you're exploring and the inspiration that it took to get you to explore it, which was having children of your own?
Well, the whole process, as you can see, has just been very organic. I mean, the Target bag is very important, but then the Target store and the Target experience is just personal and naturally developed having a family. So I think everything about this project has just come about in a very natural way. Even just thinking about children and art itself, I had always thought that children were the death of art. I mean, history is littered with female writers and painters, and they have children, and that's just kind of the end of creativity for them. And so I always thought, I'm never going to have children because I'll never paint again, and they'll just, you know, take everything from me, and that will be it. So I think it's deeply ironic, too, as a female artist, that because I had children and was able to see those photographs of myself in a different way, my children have led me to probably the most profound body of art that I'll ever create.
Yeah, it's a transformative experience becoming a parent. And I would, you know, it's got to transform everything. And yeah.
Yes. And what I have realized is children, you know, while they haven't been the death of art, they've been the death of everything else. I mean, they've been the death of like watching TV and going out to eat and having, you know, playing tennis and, you know, having lunch with friends. So, you know,
everything else they did before.
Exactly. But art has remained.
Well, so I'm curious about some of the stories that you learned from people and just what they have meant to you, because you've talked about that it was really this leap of faith for people to share mm-hmm. their referral photos with you and trust you with their stories and their experiences and their images. Can you tell a story of one of the people you met through this project that really got to you in a pretty deep way?
I've learned so much from the adoptees that have memories of their time in their home countries. Most of the people in this project came when they were infants, and so they are operating on a whole different level of questioning and mystery. But those that remember have very significant stories. And one thing that I have learned is that for those of us that came in the 70s, adoption agencies at that time told our families, take your child home, love them, everything will be okay. And they really believed that. And we now know that if you come when you're 3 or 4, however much support you receive once you're here, however well you're loved and nourished and cared for, we cannot erase the past. My cousin Glenn came when he was 4 years old, and my aunt and uncle and our whole—
Where did he come from, if you don't mind?
From Romania.
Okay.
And our whole extended family adores him, and he was adored, actually, at his orphanage in Romania, and he was a beautiful child and got whatever cuddles or food there was to be had. But he still has memories of white cribs, and he still, to this day, even though every need has been met since he got off the airplane, he still wonders where his next meal will come from, because you can't take away being hungry for 4 years in Romania.
You know, as I've kind of mentioned, international adoption and transracial adoption are both very charged topics right now. And people mm-hmm. have really strong feelings from coming from every different direction with every bit of good intention on all of those sides. What do you make of that discussion after meeting so many people who have lived it? Because so much of the conversation can center on the parents and their experiences. Mm-hmm. And just hearing about adoption through the stories of people who were adopted.
Well, I think we're also still learning from each other. One issue that is pertinent into the adoption community right now is many people aren't aware that people who are legally adopted to this country are actually being deported back to their country of origin.
Because adoption has not always guaranteed citizenship.
Well, in the year 2000, Congress passed the Child Citizenship Act, which granted automatic citizenship to international adoptees legally adopted to the United States. Prior to the year 2000, parents had, my own included, had to go through this lengthy process of naturalization, and it involved paying fees and working, I think, with the social worker and the court system, and they had to take me to court. There are an estimated, and this is, a low estimate, 35,000 to 50,000 children adopted before 2000 who were never, whose parents, for whatever reason, never completed the citizenship process. So if they apply for a passport, if they commit a crime, all of a sudden they're flagged in the system. They assumed they were citizens. And in some cases, they're being purchased a one-way ticket back to Seoul and just dropped on the streets, and they haven't been back since they were 7 months old. Right now, the Adoptee Citizenship Act is stalled legislation sponsored by Democrats and Republicans alike that will seek to retroactively grant these adoptees citizenship. But right now, politically, it's just kind of stalled out. And so I think for the adoption community, knowing that we have members of our community that are vulnerable to deportation or simply are not welcomed or feeling safe in some circumstances, when we hear politicians say things like, go back home, that really cuts pretty deeply.
Is there someone you met who you just would like to the chance to tell us about before we go? Just to add that nuance to this conversation, just a story that gets at an angle that maybe people who have no personal experience with adoption, and especially with international adoption, just might not even think about.
I think just as the question, where are you from, as I referenced earlier, can be very loaded, I think where is home is always going to be a question that adoptees have available to them to answer and to find out whether parts of their home are in a very, very far away place and they are still trying to discover that, or whether home is right here in Minnesota. Lee was an adoptee that came when she was 3 years old. She arrived in a freezing cold winter in Minnesota. She said that for 3 months when she was 3 years old, for the first 3 months in Minnesota, she only spoke Korean. And every single night, she would bundle up in all of her little possessions that she had brought from Korea. She would stand out on the front porch in the freezing cold winter, and she would wail in Korean at the top of her lungs over and over, I'm waiting for my grandfather. He is coming, flying in to pick me up. She kept pointing to the sky and crying, I want to go to a faraway place. She said at 3 months of age, once she started to speak English, that nighttime ritual just completely ended. And I find that story heartbreaking, but also fascinating. But it also gets to the heart of where is home? And we all want to be home, and we all want to be safe.
How has your own parenting journey evolved since you took on this project? It was you're thinking about your connection with your kids that started it all. Has that been affected by this project?
My mom has always been my deepest advocate and supporter and cheerleader. From the moment I got off the plane, my mom and dad, who adopted me, and my mom had always been my home. But now, with my children are my home now.
Well, Megan Rye, our time is up, but thank you so much for a really thought-provoking conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Megan's exhibit at the Spencer in Lawrence is called Foundling. It's up through December, and there are talks about the issues it explores coming up, one in October, one in November. Go to spencerart.ku.edu for details. And that's a wrap. We'll have both of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. It's where we keep all our past shows. It's where you can sign up to have them sent to you like a podcast if that suits you better. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we're talking about sustainable seafood in the Midwest. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Noah Taborda, Aviva Okeson Haberman, and Anne Kniggendorf. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.